will.illinois.edu/support.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, November, whatever it is, 2011, here on WILL AM 580. It's a pleasure to be here. We've got a terrific book we're going to be talking about today. Traditionally, people think of news media, the way it's presented in mainstream perspective, as largely a dominant institution controlled, run by, and for white people. Well, our author is today bringing us an extraordinary new book, News for All the People, talking about the real epic story of race in American media. So please join us today.
Views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
While Washington lawmakers squabble over budget cuts, a huge source of potential income is being overlooked. Money lost from corporations that exploit loopholes in the tax code to avoid paying their fair share. According to a new study of 280 companies in the Fortune 500, 78 paid zero or less in federal income tax in at least 1 year from 2008 to 2010. In the years they paid no income tax, these companies earned $156 billion in pre-tax profits. Among the companies that made enormous profits and paid next to nothing in taxes, AT&T, Comcast, General Electric, Time Warner, and Verizon. Rebecca Wilkins is the co-author of the report and the senior counsel for federal tax policy at Citizens for Tax Justice. CTJ has been doing these reports since the 1980s.
The tax rate for corporations that's in the law is 35%. You would think corporations would be paying closer to the statutory rate of 35%. But they have so many deductions and exemptions and special tax breaks and some loopholes that a lot of their income isn't subject to tax. So they're only paying an effective rate over the last 3 years of 18.5%.
Wilkins says the U.S. Treasury lost $223 billion in revenue in the last 3 years just because of these 280 tax-dodging companies. Companies have hundreds of lawyers to help them craft elaborate tax plans to create tax shelters. For example, in the last couple of years, Verizon has had two transactions in which it sold a big chunk of its landlines.
Instead of just doing an outright sale where they would have a big tax bill associated with that, they're doing this very complicated transaction so that it qualifies as tax-free under the mergers and divestitures rules in the tax code.
Tax rules have been designed to give corporations these kinds of deductions, exemptions, and write-offs. Most of the rules are in the tax code at the behest of corporate lobbyists. Companies say these tax subsidies are incentives for investment, but Wilkins says tax breaks don't influence corporate behavior very much.
Companies don't do something because they get a tax break for it, but they're really happy to go to Congress and ask for a tax break for something that they're already doing just to reduce the amount of taxes they pay.
The name of the report is Corporate Taxpayers and Corporate Tax Dodgers. It's available online at ctj.org.
At least 26 journalists have been arrested while covering Occupy Wall Street protests across the country. 13 were arrested last week in New York City. Journalist Jared Mousen was one of them. Last week, the New York Police Department evicted protesters from Zuccotti Park and denied journalists access to the scene. Mousen, who reports for the news site The Local East Village, was attempting to cover the eviction when he was swept up with the protesters and arrested. Mousen kept his camera rolling.
I'm a reporter. I'm a reporter. I am a journalist. I am a reporter. This is my press credential.
Mousen spent 7 hours in police custody and was charged with disorderly conduct.
I was completely startled to be arrested at all. I just couldn't believe it. I had actually earlier waved to the nearest policeman and pointed out my press badge and said, like, look, I'm a reporter.
Many of the journalists arrested are independent reporters, citizen journalists, or reporters who haven't been granted official NYPD credentials. Some have been violently arrested, roughed up, tear-gassed, or pepper-sprayed. Though Mousen is back on the streets, he said the experience is affecting his reporting. and predicts it could impact the decision of other journalists to come to the front lines.
It definitely gives me pause. It makes me think a lot harder about how to go about reporting these sorts of events in New York, but I have been continuing my reporting. I just tried to be even more overcautious than usual, but I can only imagine what other journalists will think seeing these now multiple cases and multiple videos of reporters being arrested simply for doing their jobs.
Mauson fears that the police crackdown on journalists, intentional or not, will also affect the type of news that gets to the public.
To report on breaking news, you have to be able to witness what's happening, especially for photographers and people filming, taking video. You have to be as close as you safely can. What we are being told with relation to Occupy Wall Street, and it specifically with relation to the clearing of the park, was that no one was allowed to be anywhere near what was happening. And that's a situation where the media can't do its job. It means that public will receive an incomplete or distorted picture of what's happening.
To follow Mauson's reporting, visit eastvillage.thelocal.newyorktimes.com.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Okie dokie, it's 1 o'clock here in WILL AM 580, 106 exactly. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, back with you with Media Matters this November 27th, 2011. Today we have a couple of terrific guests I've been looking forward to having ever since I first read the galleys for this book earlier this year. They are Juan Gonzalez and Joe Torres. Juan Gonzalez, known to many of you, of course, as the columnist of the New York Daily News and the co-host of Democracy Now!, the nationally syndicated TV and radio show. He's written several books in his career, including Harvest of Empire and Roll Down Your Window. The other guest, Joe Torres, is a senior advisor for government and external affairs for Free Press, the group I helped to start 10 years ago and I still serve on the board for. And Joe Torres, before working at Free Press, was the deputy director of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, and he's also a dear friend. Joe, Juan, thank you both for being on the program today.
Oh, thanks, Bob. My pleasure to be here.
Well, this book is truly, the subtitle for the book, The News for All the People, is The Epic Story of Race in the American Media. And this is one case where the term epic is not abused or blown up with hyperbole. It truly is. This book really lays it out there, the story from the beginning of the European colonization of North America, right through to the present day, the story of race in the American media. And if I can ask you, let's start with you, Joe, what the thinking was for behind the book when you and Juan decided to write the book? What was your ambition with this book?
Well, the ambition was to continue what we've been working on for the past 10 years. Back in 2002, Juan was elected president of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, and I was the deputy director. And as you remember well, Bob, at that year, in 2002, Michael Powell was trying to deregulate the entire media system. The FCC was trying to loosen all the media ownership rules up, and a mass citizen movement, rose up to protest. And as journalists, and working for as a journalist and working for a journalist association, we knew that this was bad for journalism, but bad for journalists of color as well and for people of color. And so we set out at first back then to educate journalists why media consolidation is terrible for the quality of journalism, because a lot of journalists have no idea. Even though they work in the newsroom, they have no idea how these rules and policies impact their daily jobs. So we set out to do that, and we created a pamphlet in 2004 to release at the Unity Journalists of Color Convention, which is the largest journalism convention in the world. 8,000 people showed up in 2004 to educate them why these issues matter. It's called How Long Must We Wait, the pamphlet. That was the name of the pamphlet, the white paper we wrote. And we were asked to take that pamphlet, and it was much like the book. It was a mini history of the journalists of color in the mass media, to expand upon that white paper, to make it into a book. And so I think the same principles back in 2004 when we wrote the pamphlet is still today, is to continue to educate journalists why policy matters, and the fact that we've been fighting for a just media system for 200 years, and for people of color to understand that the media system we have today It's come about because it organically grew like that. It's because of decisions made along the way by government that resulted in placing control of media in the hands of a few, which harms us because when we are unable to tell our own stories, or when other people tell our stories, they often get it wrong. It causes us great harm. That's why we wrote the book.
And the book does a masterful job, really, of weaving a history of the entirety of American media, particularly news media, on one hand, with media that are created and established by and for people of color, as well as how people of color have sort of worked with the dominant media over the past few hundred years. There's so much here. And one place, some of the best work in the book, some of the most enlightening, I thought, dealt with the whole area of broadcasting in the 20th century and how it has set up and established and how that affected communities of color and American democracy more broadly. And, you know, as you know, both Joe and Juan, in my own work, I started by doing a lot of research in the history of American broadcasting. And as I'd like to say, one of the most striking things doing really 7 years of archival work and all the government records surrounding broadcasting policy in the United States in the late 20s into the mid to late 30s, if you looked at all the documents I looked at and you were from another country or another planet, you would think this country was entirely comprised of white men, largely from the British Isles or from England or Scotland, a handful from Norway or Germany. And there's a smattering of a couple Irishmen and a couple of Jews along the way. But that was it. And that there were no people of color anywhere to show up whatsoever in any policymaking regarding broadcasting. And your book is really the first one I've seen that's really gone into some of the implications of what this means for the type of broadcasting system we've gotten. Juan Gonzalez, one of the really interesting stories in the book that I really wasn't aware of until I read the book was that when the Federal Radio Commission, the predecessor to the FCC, was allocating the licenses to the people who got to have radio and then later television stations in this country, they actually had an application from a group associated with the Ku Klux Klan. Can you talk about that?
Oh, yes. Well, you know, back in 1927, just as the Federal Radio Act had been passed, and as the new Federal Radio Commission was coming into being, it was still the staff of that new commission was still coming out of the Commerce Department, which was the agency that oversaw the new Federal Radio Commission. And Herbert Hoover was then the Secretary of Commerce and played a major role in sort of that early radio policy in the U.S. And there was an application from the Fellowship Forum, a Klan newspaper, to operate a radio station, move it actually from Brooklyn to Washington, D.C. And it was an overtly Klan station. And we were able to discover in the federal archives the correspondence internally within the Commerce Department over the folks who reviewed this license application and who basically said, hey, we have here a Klan organization who wants to run this station. Now, their concern, interestingly enough, of the staff was that the Klan was anti-Catholic, not so much that it was racist. But that it was anti-Catholic and warned against issuing the license. Nonetheless, the license was issued to the group who started the station. That station later actually went through several ownerships, eventually became WTOP, which is now the number one all news station in the Washington, D.C. area. There were clearly instances that we found as as radio allocations of frequency were being apportioned out. Interestingly, as you have documented in a lot of your research, how many of the university and public-oriented broadcasters were knocked off the air. Similarly, there was a real, in the amateur period in the early 1920s, there was a lot more diversity in broadcasting than people realized. We were able to dig back into the old African-American and Latino newspapers to find that there were quite a few African-Americans and Latinos who had amateur licenses back in as early as the 1920s. an amateur radio operator, John Rodriguez, in San Antonio, Texas, then got a commercial station, the second commercial station in San Antonio. We found stories of African Americans who had gotten amateur licenses. But what happens is, as the Federal Radio Commission comes into existence and then begins to reapportion, reallocate the airwaves, all of these African American and Latino amateurs were essentially knocked off the air. And so you had basically that early period of the government stepping in to regulate the airwaves, not only handed over the most desirable frequencies to the burgeoning, the new developing NBC and CBS networks, but not only knocked off the air many educational and university stations, but also sort of shut the door on African Americans and Latinos who had gotten an early start, many of them because they had been veterans of World War I, had been put into Signal Corps and learned amateur radio operation in the war, and came out and tried to use this new technology to basically provide a way for African Americans and Latinos to be heard on the airwaves.
Our guest today in Media Matters, Juan Gonzalez, you've just been listening to, and also Joe Torres. They are the co-authors of the brand new book, News for All the People, The Epic Story of Race in the American Media, just published by Verso. Gonzalez and Torres have just come off a national tour. The book is really getting a lot of attention. It is a highly original, comprehensive look at the topic and a magnificent read. If you'd like to call in with questions or comments for Gonzalez and Torres, the number here at Media Matters, 217-333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Joe Torres, you do work at Free Press. You have been intimately concerned before that with issues of media ownership and minority media ownership. And, you know, this is the backdrop, really, to the current period we're in, because once you allocate the stations, first radio, and then basically those same people get all the TV stations, they're allocated in a period of really complete white supremacy. No one else is getting dealt cards. And then they own the stations all the way through to the present day, basically, or sell them off to other wealthy individuals. But the original allocations are purely to white people. And this was part of the movement that fueled in the 60s and 70s the activist campaigns to diversify ownership of broadcast stations in the United States. How has that played out?
You're right. You know, these first stations were allocated to basically white men, and women and people of color did not get these licenses. And as a result, those first radio owners were able to build wealth, right, and build wealth to be able to buy the first TV stations. And how that played out in the 60s and the 70s, it was obviously a civil rights movement in this country that transformed our nation. But one of the areas that that really hasn't got as much attention is what was happening in the civil rights movement in regards to holding broadcasters and the Federal Communications Commission accountable for making sure people of color were able to integrate our nation's media system. So there's a historic case that more people need to know about. It's a case called WLBT in Jackson, Mississippi. And it was a station in the 50s and 60s where it was run by a white supremacist, and they were white citizens' councils were forming throughout the South as a result of Brown versus the Board of Education, which called for integrating our nation's school systems, and led to desegregation, and they will allow white citizens' councils perspective and commentary on the air of Jackson, Mississippi, even though the city was 40% black. And would not allow any African Americans on the air to counter the hostility on the air to fight against integration. We give, just historic examples is, let's say, if Thurgood Marshall was on the air on NBC on the network talking about integration issues, they will cut the signal. They would say signal problems, so they would not even broadcast national programming talking about integration on the local station. That's how extreme they went. So the United Church of Christ, with Reverend Everett C. Parker and other black leaders in Jackson, Mississippi, challenged the license of the station, challenged WLBT's license. Until then, U.S. citizens did not have any legal standing to challenge a broadcast license, even though we owned the airways. The government said you didn't have an interest, you didn't have a direct interest in challenging license. That went to court. and the court ruled that indeed that the citizens could challenge the license. And as a result of that decision, it opened the door for other groups throughout the country to do the same thing in communities across the country. So literally you had in Atlanta a guy named Lonnie King who organized a coalition of black leaders in Atlanta to challenge all the broadcast stations in Atlanta. And this happened throughout the country, in Denver, in Dallas, in New York City, where for the first time citizen groups and civil rights groups were able to challenge the broadcast licenses. Because broadcast licenses were up for renewal every 3 years, not 8 years like today, there was a great deal of pressure and leverage you can place on a station. So as a result, the stations would enter into these binding agreements with the community to say, we are going to integrate our newsrooms, we're going to improve programming, and as a result, we saw the first wave of journalists of color really entering the broadcast newsrooms in cities across the country for the first time.
Yeah, and Bob, if I can add on this to what Joe was saying, between 1970 and 1973, there were more than 340 license challenges to radio and television licenses across the nation. This was an astounding movement that arose as a direct result of the victory in the WLBT case and really spawned an entire sort of generation of media activists in the black and brown communities of the country. So it really was the – and, of course, it led us within a few years – in the Carter administration, the promulgation of congressional regulations to spur minority ownership. You had the tax certificate program, the distressed sale program. The government actually instituted structural reforms to try to assure a much more inclusive media system. But it was as a direct result of this citizen movement that developed in the late 60s and early 70s and put enormous pressure on the broadcast industry and on the government and on the courts to open up the airwaves and allow more voices to be heard.
And if I can follow up with you on that, Juan Gonzalez, another key point in the book, something you're intimately connected with, is how out of the 1960s and the turmoil of the period and the resistance movements that developed in American cities in that period, there was tremendous pressure that came upon newspaper publishers to open their newsrooms. And something I think a lot of Americans might not be familiar with, especially younger Americans, is just how entirely segregated American newspapers' news staffs were until quite recently. Can you talk a little bit about that process?
Oh, sure, because in the book we go through the isolated examples of those African Americans and Native Americans and Latinos who were in the mainstream or white press in the 19th century and early 20th century, but it really wasn't until the 1970s that you began the actual desegregation of the media system in America, and you had not only as what we've described what happened in broadcasting. But really, the impetus for the newspapers to desegregate was really the urban riots of the 1960s and then the Kerner Commission report that Lyndon Johnson authorized, the U.S. Commission on Civil Disorders, which in the Kerner Commission report in 1968, the commission laid direct blame on the media for its failure to properly report on racial problems and racial conflict in American society. And one of the direct recommendations of the Kerner Commission was the establishment of an urban journalism institute to train minority journalists and it pressed for the opening up of the newsrooms of America to African Americans in particular, but obviously that also developed in terms of Latinos and Asian Americans. And so starting in the 70s and into the late 70s, you had the first moves by the newspaper industry. The American Society of Newspaper Editors in 1978 declares as its official goal to have the newsrooms of America within 25 years reflect the general population of the country. You had the Radio and Television News Directors Association begin to also begin doing annual census of their newsrooms to try to figure out how to diversify the newsrooms, the Publishers Association. One by one, all the major industry groups admit, yes, we've had a major failing. We've got to change. And this was this also, of course, was spurred by a series of racial discrimination lawsuits that developed in the late 1970s and early 1980s against the Washington Post, New York Times, the Associated Press. And so basically you had, by the late 70s, the opening up of America's newsrooms to the first generation of journalists of color, who then encountered so much hostility when they walked into the first, you know, let's say the first African-American at the Cleveland Plain Dealer or the first one at the Denver Post, that they rapidly were forced. They were so ostracized that they had no choice but to form their own professional organizations to find some kind of support or sustenance to them. So that's how you had the development beginning in the early 70s and the late 70s and into the early 80s of these professional associations of minority journalists, the National Association of Black Journalists, National Association of Hispanic Journalists, the Asian American and the Native American Journalist Organization. It was really a reaction to the backlash that they encountered when they walked into the newsrooms and encountered so much hostility. So basically what happened is the media system in America in the 1970s was thrown into complete upheaval by a combination of citizen movement, governmental reforms, and the entrance of these first generation of minority journalists into the newsrooms of America.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Juan Gonzalez, who you've just been listening to, also Joseph Torres. They're the co-authors of the brand new book, News for All the People, The Epic Story of Race in the American Media, just published by Verso Books. Juan Gonzalez is known to many of you as the co-host of Democracy Now!, the television and radio show. He's written several books and been on there to talk about them in the past, including Harvest of Empire. Joe Torres is Senior Advisor for Government and External Affairs for Free Press, the National Media Reform Organization. And for full disclosure, I am on the board of Free Press and was one of its founders, much to my satisfaction, 10 years ago. Phone lines are open at 217-333-9455, the toll-free line, 1-800-222-9455. Please do call in with your questions and comments. Before I get back to the show, I want to take a moment now to express my thanks in regards to Melissa Trentz, who's been the producer for Media Matters for the last 2.5 years, since the summer of 2009. I know many listeners have dealt with her directly. Melissa has done a great and wonderful job here, but she'll be moving on now and leaving this position, much to my regret. And I just want to thank her over the air for her fantastic work, tireless work, over the last 2.5 years. Not always the easiest job working with Bob McChesney. And Christina Williams, who's coming in to sit in for her, take over the job beginning now. She's been working with us last month, and I'm really looking forward to working with Christina. It should be a great process. So thank you again very much, Melissa, for your fantastic work, and best wishes to you in the future. You know, let's carry the story forward now, if I can, with you, Joe Torres. We had this great movement, as Juan Gonzalez just talked about, in the 70s to get significant presence by people of color in newsrooms across the United States. And there was also pressure to have increased minority ownership of radio and television stations. Both those movements really took off in the 1970s. Where do those respective issues stand today, Joe Torres?
Well, we're actually moving backwards, particularly when it comes to ownership. Like Juan was saying, in 1978, the FCC moved forward with implementing the minority tax certificate a program that allow owners to basically get a tax break from selling stations to a person of color or a woman. And from 1978 to 1995, the number of the percentage of people of color owning broadcast stations increased from 1% to 3% as a result of these tax certificate programs. In 1994, when the Republicans came into the House and the contract with America, and Newt Gingrich came in with capturing the majority in the House, they did away with the minority tax certificate program. They got rid of it. And then the 1996 Telecom Act was passed, signed by Bill Clinton, which allowed for massive deregulation of broadcast properties, particularly in radio. So you had a company like Clear Channel goes from owning 40 stations to 1,200, literally in a matter of years. So all those stations owned by people of color were targeted and had a hard time competing, because if you only, you know, the profile of a person of color who owns a broadcast station is a small owner, a broadcast owner that likely has an AM station, and so now you have to go up against a Clear Channel that has, or other like a Cumulus or other radio giants that have a cluster of stations that they can, you know, just muscle you out of the market, basically. So minority ownership has declined as a result. And one of the things that is troubling about this very issue is that the FCC historically has never had an accurate census done on the state of minority broadcast ownership in our country. They never conducted an accurate census because the way they collect the information and the way they process the information has been, in the statistics they put out, have been inaccurate. It took to 2007, my organization, Free Press, to come out with what is seen as the first accurate census of broadcast ownership in our country. And we show that consolidation indeed is impactful to people of color for the very reasons I just explained. Another issue that the minority ownership that's really significant is that when Michael Powell tried to deregulate the broadcast ownership rules in 2002-2003, it was sued. The citizens group sued and took the FCC to court. In 2004, the rules were stayed from being implemented. But the court said that the FCC had failed to address the issue of minority ownership, because in the statute, in the telecommunications statute, it says you have to lower the barriers to entry to allow new entrants to enter the market. That's the job of the FCC, to make sure that there's a diversity of voices, and that the FCC had failed to do that. In 2007, Republican Chairman Kevin Martin tried to deregulate the ownership rules. And again, in this past July, the court ruled, threw those rules out, and said it once again, more sternly, that the FCC once again has failed to address the issue of minority ownership. Now we have Chairman Jenna Kasky about to tee up ownership rules once again. And it seems he has not addressed the issue of how any rule changes will impact minority and female ownership. So this Thursday in Atlanta, Commissioner Copps and Commissioner Clyburn are actually going to hold a hearing on minority ownership and media ownership, and that's going to take place in Atlanta. So it has not gone away. The fact that the ownership is declining for people of color, and the FCC has failed to address how to reverse this.
And Bob, I'd like to underline that, because, you know, many people listening to your show will say, well, what's the big deal about minority ownership? Well, this is the reality. Everybody knows the population of the United States is undergoing enormous change. And the main change that is occurring, and that will continue to occur for decades to come, is that the minority population of the United States continues to increase exponentially, to the point where African Americans, Latinos, and Asian Americans, by somewhere between 2040 and 2050, will comprise a majority of the country. The white population of the country will begin to become a minority population somewhere between 2040 and 2050. No one denies that that's going to happen. Yet, as the minority population of the country continues to increase dramatically, the ownership of newspapers, radio and television stations, which still remain the main way that most people get their news and information, is increasingly, the minority ownership is decreasing. So you're facing the reality that within 20 years or 30 years, we're going to be faced with a de facto apartheid media system, where a white minority will essentially control the major means of mass communications. Now, of course, there's still the issue of the internet, which we can certainly get into, and how the internet will either democratize or not our media system. But the old legacy media systems have continued to be resistant to being inclusive in ownership. They will talk to you about, well, we've increased the percentage of minorities in these newsrooms. But, of course, the increase is nothing like the increase in the population, the general population of the country. It's still lagging way behind. So we're faced with the fact that we're heading toward a de facto apartheid media system in America, unless we do something about the ownership issue.
Now, Juan, let me do a follow-up, if I can, on this point, because the number of working journalists, paid working journalists by any media, old or new, has plummeted dramatically in the last decade, and there are no signs that it's going to turn around. And this means that pretty much any city you go to, a newsroom is going to be a lot smaller in terms of paid employees than it was 2000 or certainly 1990. And how does this affect communities of color, not just the working journalists in those newsrooms, but neighborhoods and communities primarily of people of color?
Well, I think what happens inevitably is that whenever there's shrinkage in these media companies, and I've worked at many of them over the years, the first audience to be discarded along with the journalists are those audiences that are less desirable to advertisers. So there is a constant upscaling of the audience that occurs, whether it's in print or in broadcast. If you have fewer reporters and you can reach, you know, you can have vital information to fewer people, you're going to try to keep your most affluent viewers and your most affluent readers. So if you have to cut circulation, the first place you cut circulation is in the minority areas. If you are no longer as interested in the kind of shows that attract a wide variety of audiences, you want to keep your affluent, your most affluent readers. So by the very logic of the economics of these stations, they are increasingly trying to reach the demographic that most appeals to advertisers, that has the most disposable income. So the very nature of the market means that racial minorities tend to be, have lower income levels and tend to be regarded as marginal to the main consumer market, will continue to be discarded or forgotten.
Our guest, Juan Gonzalez, who you've just been listening to, and Joe Torres, they're the co-authors of the new book, News for All the People, The Epic Story of Race in the American Media, just published by Verso. Lines are open here at Media Matters. We're live today at 217-333-9455, our toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to our first caller right now. Line 1, Champaign County, you're on the air.
Hi. I believe it was the Democracy Now! Interview where the theme, one of the themes of free press was expounded on. I'd like to hear it again, I guess, and for the audience, the idea that the U.S. In the early days, and I think your book goes back to very early days of U.S. Dynamics in the press field, that there was a subsidy for pamphlets. There was a subsidy for newsprint. This is not something that's new. So I'd like, and the implications are that if we're really in a democracy and there is a right to communicate as a group and individual, as some say, that there should be a proactive way of getting people the right to communicate. And then just as a one-off, just on a sidebar, and maybe you know about it, I could have just wikied it, I guess, but what were the dynamics of the KPFT's transmitter being blown up twice in Houston, I guess, in the Vietnam era? Was that a racial story predominantly, or was it an anti-war story? I think it's a one-off, so I'll hang up and listen.
Well, thank you very much. And Joe Torres, you know, yesterday you and I corresponded by email, and I asked you what sort of issues were people really interested in your talks that you and Juan Gonzalez have given around the book over the last few weeks. And number one on your list was precisely the policies that allowed for the creation of ethnic papers. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure, sure. So when the U.S. postal system was created in 1792, one of the things that it said that the government could not surveillance mail. So there could not be any censorship of mail. But the most important thing is that after debates of whether the delivery of mail and newspapers should be free or should there be some sort of subsidy, the government decided to subsidize the delivery of newspapers. And as a result, literally by 1830, 1840s, 95% of the weight, the mail weight being delivered in our country were newspapers, and it allowed the first ethnic newspapers because it was a decentralized system. The postal system created the newspaper industry that was decentralized, that it didn't place control of the industry in the hands of a few. It allowed the voices of many to participate. It was the very reason, incredibly enough, given this time of historic discrimination of our country, for the first African-American newspaper, Freedom's Journal in 1827 to be founded, the Cherokee Phoenix in 1828, El Mississippi in 1808 in New Orleans. It allowed for the creation of literally 100 or more ethnic newspapers in our country to be published because the papers got delivered, and publishers were able to deliver newspapers to each other for free. So it's a decentralized system, and is the very principle of a decentralization, which you talk about all the time in your book, that we're still fighting for today. We argue in our book, whenever people of color have benefited most from media policy, it allow our voices to allow us to speak for ourselves and tell our own stories, is when policy promotes greater decentralization of media.
Yeah, and if I can answer that as well, people don't realize that the postal system was, in essence, our first internet. The government's decision to create a postal system in the way that it did, and it was particularly important in our country because this was, after all, a settler country. We added states by expanding territory and having those states admitted into the Union. So, therefore, the founders from the very beginning understood the importance of the dissemination of news and information to keeping the country bound together. So they, after a very important information communications debate in 1792, decided on this second-class postal system as the way that newspapers would be delivered. And if you look at the debates in Congress throughout the 19th century, there were almost annual debates over postal subsidies. And there were often debates, really not over the subsidies, but there were debates over what kind of an information system does a democracy need. For example, the smaller states argued for greater subsidies for the newspapers that circulated within a state vis-a-vis those who would come from outside. Why? Because the political leaders in the smaller states were fearful that the newspapers of the big cities in the East would dominate their local media if they were supplied at the same rate. So out-of-state papers had less of a subsidy than in-state papers. And then in the late 19th century, Congress adopted free rural delivery, where basically if you were a publisher of a newspaper in some small rural area, you got your newspaper delivered not at subsidized rate. You got it delivered for free. That was a government decision that said that we believe that the development of news and information for people in the rural areas is so important that we're going to, like, change the rules for the delivery of the postal system just for the rural areas. So these were all debates over how information and news will flow in a democracy. And they were camouflaged as debates over postal subsidies. But in essence, they were debates over the government's role in assuring a decentralized system of news and information delivery. So when people tell you these days, well, let the market take care of everything, well, every technology has required government support, subsidy, and intervention, whether it was the Internet, which was essentially funded by government grants to ARPA and then the National Science Foundation to develop the original Internet, whether it was the NASA putting all those satellites into orbit that allowed this enormous satellite broadcasting system that we have in existence today in the country, you know, whether it was early radio. Every new technology has required one, government subsidy, and then government regulation to decide how the new technology will operate and what will be its contribution to the way that citizens in America get their news and information. So one of the things I think that, aside from the historical racial, the history of the race coverage in America that we try to do in this book, is we try to show how the system, the overall system of news, developed from the earliest newspapers to the present. What was the government's role? What was technology's role? And then what were the roles of the various groups of citizens, whether they are ordinary citizens, business people, media owners, in this sort of battle to shape our media system?
And I can say I think you do a fairly successful job of that, which is a daunting task, to put it mildly, Juan Gonzalez. The caller did refer to the KPFT incident of it being firebombed in the 1960s. I don't know if you're familiar with that, Juan.
Yes, somewhat. I mean, it was KPFT, and I think in its first year in operation was firebombed twice by the by the KKK. So while it was in the, it was the station that was very heavily anti-war, it clearly, I think the inspiration for those who were seeking to attack the station was not so much its anti-war stand, but was the fact that the station was also advocating for racial equality at a time in Texas when that was still a hotly debated topic in that state.
You know, there's so much in this book, News for All the People, historically through to the present. It's such a rich document. We could take any chapter and do an entire program on it. So it pains me that we aren't going to give this book the attention it deserves in this hour. But I do want to jump ahead to a current policy issue that you referred to, Joe, and you've written about and talked about, which is this whole battle for the Internet that Juan Gonzalez just alluded to. You know, what is the state of the battle for the open Internet now, and what's the role of civil rights groups right now in this battle with telecom companies?
Well, the state of net neutrality, when we talk about Internet freedom and the future of the Internet, we're talking about whether the Internet is going to be a decentralized system, as we've been talking about, or a centralized system. So what do I mean by that? I mean that folks connect to the Internet by an ISP, an Internet Service Provider, whether it's Comcast, Verizon, AT&T, whatever you have to connect to the Internet. They have a tremendous ability. They have the ability to speed up or slow down web content based on a person's ability to pay. So if I want to visit your website, Bob, or I want to visit a website, The Nation or La Opinión, I can get there just as fast as I can get to CNN or The New York Times. All web traffic is treated equally. But what these companies want to do is that they want to say, if I have a website and I'm a startup, I have to pay them more to make sure people can access my site just as fast as they can access any other site. And that will create the same kind of barriers to entry, the same kind of barriers that we've been trying to dismantle in traditional media. And it's going to impact those who do not have the deep pockets to be able to make sure they're able to compete. And so that's going to, again, is going to be women, people of color, folks who are marginalized, who don't have wealth to be able to have a voice online. And so when President Obama was running as candidate, he said he was going to take a backseat to no one on this issue of what we call network neutrality, treating all web content equally, web traffic equally. And the FCC last December passed a rule, which is said that Internet freedom, Internet fairness, network neutrality, whatever you want to call it, on your broadband that you get at home, your wired broadband connection, that there shouldn't be discrimination on there. When it comes to your wireless connection, the rules just went into effect this past month, that these companies will have the ability, if you connect to the Internet through your wireless device, to be able to prevent you from accessing the content you want. You're able to play a pay-per-play system, so your website may be slowed down for users trying to access your site through a wireless connection. Why is this important? Again, the future of the Internet, more and more people are going to choose mobility to connect to the Internet, and actually the speeds become faster on your wireless devices. That's how people are going to choose to connect to the Internet. On the civil rights groups, it's been a major it's been a lot of tension around this issue because the telecom companies have done a good job of supporting the programs of civil rights groups, the scholarship funds, their conferences, you know, really important stuff. And a lot of these groups are having a hard time. They don't find money for foundations, and government funding has dwindled. And so they have to play an ever-increasing role in servicing their community. And the telecom companies have stepped in and literally spend millions of dollars in funding a lot of different groups. And as a result, a lot of these groups are taking supporting positions that are arguing for a centralized control of media, which will harm our community, I believe. I believe a lot of these organizations do not understand the issue. Some are ideologically aligned with the companies. They believe the companies have the right answer for the community. And so it's a major fight over this, and there's a lot of media justice groups and other groups who do not take corporate funding who are challenging that and saying, no, we need a decentralized system.
Our guests today, Juan Gonzalez and Joe Torres. You've just been listening to Joe Torres, authors of News for All the People. We've got a caller who's been waiting patiently. Let's go to that caller now. Line one, Farmer City, you're on the air.
I have a question that I guess I need to understand more about advertising. If stations were going to the more affluent as the advertisers, then we would all be listening to NPR because more educated people will go to NPR or, you know, in this case, WIOL. So it seems to me that in our radio market, there are radio stations for every income group, and sometimes they are ethnic and sometimes they're not. But if there are different stations, regardless of who owns them, targeting the different income groups or racial groups, what happens when we have the minorities being the majorities? If they are the largest consumer groups, wouldn't the stations gravitate towards selling towards them more, and therefore we don't have many of the issues that have been talked about, you know, because in this case, the market would take care of serving those populations that have more acquisition power.
Well, okay, caller, thank you very much. Juan, do you want to field that one?
Yeah, I would say this. One is, it's clear that obviously as the overall population changes, any business owner is going to try to reach that market. But one of the things that the FCC has itself documented through a series of studies is that ownership matters in terms of the content, of what kind of content you produce, that when you have a situation where you have a major company that's, let's say, a chain that is owning a variety of stations all around the country, 100, 200, in the case of Clear Channel, at one point, 1,200 stations, those owners do not have as much a need to deal with the local needs of a community. See, because one of the key issues about the media in America is that we have so many television stations and so many newspapers that one of the things that the FCC and the government decided early on is that if you have a broadcast license, you have to serve the needs of your local community, and that means being able to, if there are senior citizens, if there are smaller groups of people that may not be as much attractive to advertisers, that you've got to serve their needs as well. What will happen when you have concentrated ownership is that the owners are always looking for, even if it's in the minority community, they want the most affluent group in the minority community. They don't necessarily want groups that are not going to be attractive to advertisers. You know, there used to be a saying in New York that the stores like Bloomingdale's would not want to advertise in the New York Post because they took the position that the New York Post readers are our shoplifters, they're not our customers. So that there is a sense among the owners that if they want to be able to upscale their audience if they are downsizing. Now, not if they're becoming a mass, not if they're trying to reach everyone as much as possible, but if they are forced to downsize, they want to reach the upscale audience, and they don't necessarily want to respond to the local needs of each community. For instance, you in radio, you now get a situation where one owner will have a bunch of radio stations where they don't even have a live person in a particular radio station, but they will regionally broadcast from one spot to 10 or 12 or 15 cities the same programming. Again, not meeting local needs, often trying to get the cream of their audience because that's what the advertisers want.
You know, in the book, Juan Gonzalez and Joe Torres, you know, what's really some of the most interesting work to me was the work on the 19th century and early 20th century, the importance of newspapers specifically and magazines to the abolitionist movement, to progressive political movements. They really were almost defined entirely by their media, and therefore those postal subsidies are imperative for these communities and these activists to survive. The other side of the coin, though, and something we've only got a few minutes left, but I think it's something our listeners should hear about, is the role of the dominant press in the United States in the late 19th and 20th century in the, you know, lynching terror campaign in the U.S. South in the in that era, and the role the dominant newspapers played as African Americans were being strung up and lynched and terrorized at, you know, a spectacular rate. Joe, Juan, either of you field that one?
Yeah, I just I'll jump real quick. It's just a yes, they played a cheerleading position, and sometimes they were the ones they were responsible for mass riots, whether it was in East St. Louis or whether it was in Vicksburg, Mississippi. And not just African Americans getting lynched, but also Mexican Americans. There's a great deal of Mexican Americans being lynched in the Southwest because these papers played a role in advocating violence against people of color, whether it was trying to get rid of elected officials, and particularly after Reconstruction or during Reconstruction. So, and after the Civil War. So yes, I'll pass it off to Juan so he can jump in here too. But that's very much true. We document at least a dozen examples of this.
Right. Well, we've shown in numerous examples, and with Native Americans as well, the Sand Creek Massacre in Colorado, the Camp Grant Massacre in Arizona. These were actually spearheaded, defended by the local newspapers. The Zoot Suit Riots in Los Angeles, where the L.A. Times basically cheered on the sailors that rampaged through the Mexican-American neighborhood of Belvedere, attacking Chicano youth. And we actually list the papers that were involved, who were the publishers that fomented this, and of course the biggest one being the 1898 Wilmington coup, the only successful armed uprising against the local government in American history, organized, led, and fomented by the editor and publisher of the Raleigh Observer, Josephus Daniels. Who later went on to become Secretary of the Navy.
If I can interrupt you, Juan Gonzalez, when I read that, I mean, because Josephus Daniels, people study American political history, is a dominant figure in that era, and he was involved in this extraordinary incident.
Yes. Not only was he involved in it, he bragged about it. he wrote about a three-part autobiography, because he was a prolific writer as well as a politician and a publisher, and he bragged about meeting in his newspaper with the local white supremacists, organizing the coverage of his newspaper to pave the way for the coup. Where they actually, a couple of thousand armed white supremacists marched into Wilmington, burned down the local black newspaper, ordered all of the elected black officials out of town, and installed a former Confederate colonel as the new mayor of Wilmington. And then proceeded to massacre dozens of African Americans as they shot up the black community. And yet Josephus Daniels was never held responsible for any of this, even though he openly boasted about his involvement and his leadership role in this incident.
Joe Torres, we've only got a few seconds left. Just final thoughts, if you could. How has the response been to the book and your tour so far?
Well, I think the response has been great. We actually were fortunate enough to make the New York Times bestseller list for a week. You know, and we have a small publishing press that was totally grassroots efforts, totally people. I think that showed that there's a great deal of hunger for this information, particularly amongst communities of color. And we had about 4,000 people show up to our events, 3,500, 4,000 people show up to our one-week book tour event. So, yeah, I think hopefully this will let people know that the fight for a just media system, there's nothing new about it, that there are a lot of heroes and folks that we can realize that we are part of that. We're a part of that long struggle.
Well, thank you so much, Joseph Torres and Juan Gonzalez, for joining me today on Media Matters. It's been an honor having you on the show with me.
Thank you, Bob. Our pleasure to be here.
Juan and Joe are the authors of the new book, News for All the People, The Epic Story of Race in the American Media. I'm Bob McChesney. I want to thank again for the last time Melissa Trentz for her great work. And I want to welcome Christina Williams on board. Kyle Kroha, thank you for working the boards. We'll see you all in 1 week. We'll be right back.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, AM 580 and 90.9 FM, HD3, Urbana. A chance of rain throughout the day in Champaign-Urbana, cloudy with a high near 41 degrees, wind gusts coming from the northwest at around 20 miles per hour. This evening, mostly cloudy with low